Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Bubalow. I'm the Deputy Director and Research Director here at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. Welcome to today's lecture at the Lowy Institute by the Honourable Michael Keenan, MP, the Minister for Justice, and the Minister assisting the Prime Minister for Counterterrorism. The Minister will be speaking today on the evolving terrorist threat to Australia. In recent years, terrorism has, of course, topped the list of security concerns of many Australians, and that's certainly reflected consistently in our Lowy Institute polling on the topic. Now, in think tanks, we spend a lot of time talking and thinking about the potential for things that are much more strategically significant or much more devastating than terrorism. For example, the possibility of wars between countries. But what distinguishes a terrorist threat is that we're already facing the threat today. It's already costing many lives. It's already disrupting relations between countries. It's already damaging social cohesion within countries and costing the international community many billions of dollars. It's also, as the title of the Minister's speech today implies, an evolving threat. Just as we see coalition forces closing in on Mosul, leading probably to the collapse of Islamic State's so-called caliphate, we should still expect that there will be responses from Islamic State and its supporters elsewhere. Indeed, we need to think hard now about how the nature of the terrorist threat may change in the future and to be smart and nimble in our responses. In that regard, I'd like to draw your attention to a recent piece of research published by the Institute on the future of the foreign fighter problem, foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq, the day after, by Roger Shanahan and Livia Khalil. There are some copies of the report also in the room today, so you can grab one. And of course, they're also available on our website. Speaking of which, not long after we finish the lecture today, you should be able to visit the Institute's new website, which will go live. That also includes a new site for the interpreter. And so today, the Lowy Institute will be getting a fresh and bold new look. We aim at the Institute to be a world-leading digital think tank, and this new design is an important step towards that ambition. The last few years, you've seen elements of that ambition through digital interactives, such as the Lowy Institute poll and the Global Diplomacy Index. With our new site, we'll have a platform to integrate initiatives and other multimedia elements, more deeply into all of our research. The site will also be easier to navigate and will present our research and commentary in a striking and easy to read way. You'll also see a new look for our digital magazine, The Interpreter. We think that The Interpreter is Australia's leading magazine for daily commentary and analysis of world events, and our new look reflects this evolution. The Interpreter will have a true front page where we can highlight the best and most important articles of the day. So keep a lookout for that, perhaps when you head home or on your phones after about 2 o'clock today. We're very grateful that the Minister has taken time out of his very busy schedule to be with us today. We're welcoming for the second time to the Institute. He also graciously spoke to us last year in our old building, 31 Bligh Street. Mr. Keenan's role within the government is to lead the Commonwealth's efforts to counter violent extremism and to ensure effective and integrated implementation of Australia's counterterrorism strategy. He is the primary contact for the Prime Minister for both day-to-day counterterrorism matters and in a terrorism crisis. The Honourable Michael Keenan MP was elected to the House of Representatives in 2004 and was appointed Minister assisting the Prime Minister on counterterrorism in May 2015. He has served as Minister for Justice since September 2013. He has a BA from Murdoch University and Charles University in Prague, a BA Honours from the Australian National University, and an MPhil from Cambridge University. Please join me in welcoming Minister Keenan.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony, for that introduction. It is very nice to be back here at the Lowy Institute for the second time. I appreciate the invitation, of course, to speak here. Now, the last time I spoke to the Institute was July last year, and whilst important parts of the terrorism landscape that we face in Australia remain familiar, there's also been some significant changes. This continuing evolution of the threat and how we address it is going to be the theme of my speech today. Now, and I'm specifically focusing on how the government must continually position ourselves to stay ahead of this threat in terms of resourcing, legislation and outlook. The basic message is this: protecting Australia from terrorism has never been more complex, with threats becoming harder to disrupt and harder for us to prevent. Although most here are familiar with the terrorist threat in Australia, a brief historical overview helps us to put the CT challenges we currently face into perspective. Even before 2001, terrorism was not a new phenomenon in Australia. Some of the most significant incidents included the Sydney Hilton bombing in 1978, the assassination of the Turkish consul in Sydney in 1980, the bombing of the Hakanoa Club and the Israeli consulate in Sydney in 1982, and the Turkish consulate bombing in Melbourne in 1986. Now, whilst alarming, these incidents were sporadic, had differing motivations, and did not represent the direct targeting of Australia per se. The rise of Al-Qaeda in the 1990s changed this. Australia and Australians were now a specific target, named in Al-Qaeda propaganda, and targeted both abroad and here at home. For the first time, a small but significant number of Australians were directly engaged with a terrorist group offshore or active supporters of a terrorist group here at home. The number of Australians involved during this period was deeply concerning at the time. Between 1990 and 2010, 30 Australians travelled to Afghanistan or Pakistan to train at terrorist camps or to fight. 25 of these individuals subsequently returned to Australia, and 19 engaged in activities of security concern following their return. 8 were subsequently convicted of terrorism-related offences, and 5 are still serving their prison sentences for those crimes. Due to the good work of Australia's law enforcement and security agencies, there were no terrorist attacks on Australian soil between 2001 and 2014, and our authorities disrupted 4 significant plots during that time. While the emergence of Al-Qaeda posed a new and serious challenge, the next manifestation of global Islamic terrorism in the form of ISIL has been of a different order entirely, requiring us to rethink our approach to the terrorist threat. A quick look at the more significant numbers tells the story of how our current experience differs from that before. In the 4 years since 2012, around 200 Australians have travelled to Syria and Iraq to join the conflict. Around 110 are currently fighting or engaged with terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq. And around 200 people here in Australia are being investigated currently for providing support to individuals and groups in the Syria-Iraq conflict, including through funding and facilitation of travel, or are themselves seeking to travel to the war zone. The overwhelming majority of these are young men and women who have bought into the ISIL worldview. Since I last spoke at Lowy, there have been significant changes to these numbers. Back then, up to 35 Australians were believed to have been killed in the conflict zone. That figure now stands as many as 68. The number of terrorist attacks on Australian soil is now 4, not 2. There have now been 11 terrorist disruptions occurring in Australia. In July last year when I spoke, there had been 5. When I last spoke here, around 23 people had been charged as a result of 8 counter-terrorism operations around Australia. This figure now stands at 51 people charged as a result of 21 counter-terrorism operations. As a result, there are currently 38 people before the courts and 17 individuals serving custodial sentences for terrorism-related offences. When I spoke last, DFAT had cancelled or suspended 145 passports. This figure now stands at 190. Within these figures from the last 12 months, there are some new and disturbing trends, some of which we had anticipated or expected based on events overseas. These included the first female charged with terrorism offences, the first extreme right-wing activist charged with terrorism offences, a significant number of minors facing terrorism charges, most recently including the two 16-year-olds arrested on the 12th of October, and the first asset forfeiture related to terrorism. All these figures speak to the scale of the problem, and each of them represents new challenges for investigators, prosecutors, and legislators. What they don't show clearly is the day-to-day reality for our law enforcement and security agencies. Each increase and new variation represents an added impost on their capabilities. That is why, since coming to government, we've increased counterterrorism funding to our agencies by $1.3 billion. But it's not just about throwing more resources or adopting new legislation. It is also about doing things more intelligently and cooperatively between governments, the private sector, and the community. The growth in these numbers in just over a year is down to the continued virulence, prevalence, and appeal of the ISIL message. In the last 12 months, there have been major changes in the way this message has been propagated. New social media platforms, many of them encrypted, have appeared, challenging our ability to stem this message. These same platforms also challenge the ability of our agencies to monitor individuals of concern. ISIL wants to generate global attention, create panic, and spread fear. In this information age, we are never far away from a reminder of the fact that a terrorist attack in Australia remains probable. It is something we see daily in the media and through our personal news feeds on social media. The basis of Australia's countering violent extremism work is to intervene as early as we possibly can before a person forms hardened views that could result in then harming themselves or others. To this end, we have invested more than $45 million over 4 years to counter violent extremism, more than tripling previous investments in this area. We have long understood that individuals do not adopt an extremist mindset through a linear or predictable process. Identifying people at a point where they are vulnerable to this ideology can be very difficult. It relies heavily on the information we receive from non-government sources, such as workplaces, communities, and families. We're committed to, and this government has invested heavily in, taking preventative action where possible. These efforts bridge social and security policy, and these two policy areas must complement each other. Our social policies are designed to reduce vulnerability to harm, including extremist ideas, by increasing education, employment, and economic opportunities for people. We work in our communities to understand the issues that are most affecting them. We work together to protect those who might be targets of extremist recruitment efforts by presenting alternatives to this extremist propaganda. In recent times, our work has expanded to include research into potential links between acts of violent extremism and mental health. This work includes actively looking at all areas of potential vulnerability that may lead to an act of violence. We work with industry, regulatory, and international partners to limit access to and disrupt violent extremist propaganda online. And we continue to work with communities and influential spokespeople to discredit that propaganda and promote alternative positive messages. An important part of the government's effort has been our investment of $21.7 million to tackle this extremist propaganda. Last year, the Council of Australian Governments agreed to progress CVE initiatives across a range of priority areas, including families, schools and youth, communities, prisons, evaluation and research, strategic communication, and the online environment. This is an effort to strengthen Australia's capability to tackle the problem of young Australians radicalising. They prioritise prevention and early intervention by providing training and support to those on the front line, helping people who may already be adopting violent ideologies, such as families, friends, community leaders, support services, and schools. Significant achievements have been made in this complex environment, and this is indicative of the effective collaboration that has occurred across all Australian governments. It also demonstrates we are world leaders in tackling the foundations of the terror landscape. To further support the Australian community, last year we launched the Report Online Extremism Tool, a website for people to report violent extremist materials that they've come across online. Of the reports provided by the public, about 1 in 5 breached social media conditions, and the government worked with social media providers to have it removed. Well-informed and well-equipped families, strong communities, and engaged institutions such as schools and workplaces are the front line of our defence against online grooming and radicalisation. We've invested $5 million with the Australian Multicultural Foundation to help parents of vulnerable or at-risk teens identify and manage the risks associated with this online radicalisation. The Office of the eSafety Commissioner is also leading this work to roll out digital literacy programs to help young people distinguish between information that is reliable and information that is untrustworthy. There is a lot of evidence that these efforts are working. In May this year, Australia's Director General of Security, Duncan Lewis, reported that the number of Australians travelling to the Syria-Iraq conflict zone had plateaued. He noted the signs that our CVE programs were gaining traction and cited this work as a contributing factor for that. Australia has a small but growing number of prisoners incarcerated for terrorism-related offences. We're continuing to work with corrective services to provide education and support to prevent or counter the spread of violent extremist ideology within our prisons. An important part of this is developing a training model for corrections staff that has been rolled out to 3,500 officers across the country to help them to identify and manage radicalisation. The government has also funded pilot de-radicalisation programs in New South Wales and Victorian prisons. The Australian government continues to invest additional resources in disrupting the activities of those in Australia and offshore who continue to plan violent attacks. Australia's agencies are very well placed to meet this threat, and at the heart of their successes we have enjoyed is the close cooperation that we enjoy across all Australian jurisdictions. The joint counter-terrorism teams in each state and territory, established in 2002, have done excellent work and are prime examples of this cooperation between the Commonwealth and the states. The JCTTs have been at the forefront of disrupting 11 terrorist plots in Australia since 2001. The JCTTs have been complemented by the establishment of the Multi-Agency National Disruption Group, which is led by the Australian Federal Police and which we established in 2014. The National Disruption Group facilitates enhanced cooperation between various state and Commonwealth agencies. This allows us to examine the options that are available to mitigate threats and prevent, disrupt and prosecute Australians who travel offshore to engage in or undertake training related to terrorism, as well as those that provide support to them. Many people who are engaged with extremism are also engaged in a variety of other criminal activities. By addressing these other criminal activities, not only is justice done and community expectations met, but the capacity and the will of these individuals to continue those extremist activities is limited. The AFP has also established a returning terrorism suspects team, which works with agencies from across the Australian government and internationally to coordinate the management of returning Australian foreign fighters. Terrorists returning from the conflict zone have the potential to cause serious security concerns, especially if our earlier experience of returnees from the Afghan conflict is any indication. Each one will pose differing degrees of risk, and the returning terrorism suspects team can manage returnees on a case-by-case basis. Our security agencies are among the best in the world, but we need to ensure that they have the powers that they need. Since August 2014, the Australian government has taken 5 tranches of legislation through the Parliament. This legislation has helped to ensure that our agencies have the necessary tools to combat this terrorism threat. This has included introducing new offences, creating new powers, strengthening existing ones, and perhaps most important of all, responding to the lessons that we have learned from our domestic counter-terrorism operations. For example, before 2014, Australia already had a range of laws prohibiting Australians from travelling overseas to engage in foreign conflicts. However, difficulties around collecting evidence in conflict zones, particularly in areas where there is no recognised government, made it hard to establish these offences. The Foreign Fighters Act created a new offence for travelling to or being in a declared area. The Act also included amendments to enhance the collection and admissibility of foreign evidence in terrorism proceedings. On home soil, passport suspension powers have been created to better enable our authorities the time to assess security risks and act accordingly. Australia is not in the business of exporting terrorism, and we cannot run the risk that Australians will go overseas, develop new skills, new networks, and then that deepen their ideological belief and then return home. The arrest threshold for terrorism offences was lowered, giving police the ability to intervene and disrupt terrorism activities at an earlier point. This has been an essential tool in many counter-terrorism operations, including some of our successful disruptions. Regrettably, we are seeing minors engaged in terrorism activities, including children as young as 14. Of the 38 people currently before our courts for terrorism-related offences, 6 are juveniles. A year ago, there were none. Seeking to stay ahead of this development, the Australian government has introduced new legislation which will allow control orders to be placed on persons 14 years or older with the appropriate safeguards. This is a sad but necessary sign of the times. The bill also introduces a new offence of advocating genocide. This will be important in curbing some of the more dangerous extremist rhetoric that, if it goes unchallenged, threatens Australia's social cohesion. It is important to manage terrorist offenders who may continue to pose an unacceptable risk to the community following the expiry of their sentences. This is especially so given the growing number of people convicted and sentenced for these terrorism offences. Most states and territories have already enacted post-sentence preventative detention schemes for dealing with high-risk sex or violent offenders, but currently there is no specific scheme for convicted terrorist offenders. The High-Risk Terrorist Offenders Bill introduces a new regime that will enable the Supreme Court, upon application by the Attorney General, to make an order for the ongoing detention of high-risk terrorism offences who continue to pose an unacceptable risk of committing serious terrorism offences if they were to be released. Given the need to ensure the right balance between restricting individual liberties and freedoms and protecting the community, the scheme contains significant safeguards, including that any decision is made by a court and is subject to regular review. As our enemies work across borders, we too support our friends and allies in this global fight against terrorism. For many years, Australian agencies have worked closely with partners around the world, especially in Southeast Asia, to support the effective investigation and disruption of people engaged in terrorism, as well as prevent the movement of terrorists across borders. Our regional cooperation comes in many forms. There is the ongoing engagement of law enforcement and security agencies, exchanging information and building capacity. Our engagement is constantly evolving, becoming wider in scope and deeper in commitment. In June this year, Australia partnered with Indonesia to produce a regional risk assessment on terrorism financing in Southeast Asia, the first time that an assessment of this type has ever been undertaken. This assessment supports our efforts to understand, coordinate, and respond to risks associated with terrorism financing in our region. On the CVE front, I recently launched a regional compendium of counter-narratives. Australia produced this resource with our Southeast Asian partners and the Hidayah Research Institute. The compendium provides advice on how to counter violent extremist ideology in an effective and compelling way. It was a key deliverable from the 2014 Regional CVE Summit held here in Sydney, another flagship regional initiative that has been championed by Australia. On the other side of the world, we are strengthening our cooperation with countries in the Middle East. As part of the government's response to the problem of foreign fighters, we have expanded the AFP's footprint in the region with new AFP positions in both Ankara and Amman. They form part of the AFP's international network across 28 countries and the 16 bilateral counter-terrorism cooperation agreements that we have worldwide. Australia also continues to be an active member of the Global Coalition, 60 international partners committed to tackling ISIL on all fronts. Terrorist tactics are constantly evolving and changing, and this is another area that we must constantly reassess. While a large coordinated attack like that favoured by Al-Qaeda cannot be ruled out, at the moment a terrorist attack in Australia is most likely to be undertaken by an individual or a small group using weapons and tactics that are low cost, relatively simple and easy to acquire. ISIL has long called for supporters to use any means at their disposal to do so without guidance or instruction. Government agencies that are working against terrorists, such as the military, police and security services, are prime targets for terrorist attacks. Indiscriminate attacks are also encouraged and planned, both here and overseas, and the risk to the general public in Australia remains strong. Looking ahead, we will need to be prepared for more change, especially in response to shifts in the international security environment and the potential return of foreign fighters to their home countries. Islamic State is in retreat in both Syria and Iraq. ISIL has now lost more than 50% of the populated areas it once held in Iraq, and it will soon face the loss of Mosul, its last major population centre in the country. In Syria, forces opposed to ISIL now control the majority of territory along the Syria-Turkey border, and they're applying pressure to ISIL near Raqqa, the so-called second capital of the caliphate. This is in clear contrast to the situation a year ago when ISIL controlled an area larger than Lebanon, which contained more than 4 million people, and due to the extensive resources at their disposal, was being described at the time as the wealthiest terror organisation to have ever existed. As ISIL suffers military defeat, its modus operandi will change. ISIL in Iraq and Syria will revert to being an underground terrorist organisation. It will also seek to expand its networks in Europe and elsewhere, including here in our own region. Of the thousands of foreign fighters, many will continue to die on the battlefield, but others will seek to return to their country of origin and continue this struggle. This will include a number of Australians, all of whom would have had lengthy military experience, a deepening commitment to the ISIL cause, and a network of like-minded comrades from around the world. If they cannot return here, they may go elsewhere, which remains a major concern. In Southeast Asia, ISIL has directed and inspired terror attacks in Indonesia and Malaysia and encouraged kidnap-for-ransom operations in the Philippines. There are hundreds of regional foreign fighters that could seek to return to their countries of origin, and the ISIL message is already gaining traction there in a bigger way than Al-Qaeda's message ever did. We know that some Australian foreign fighters have families in Syria and Iraq. Even those not directly involved in fighting, especially children, may return having been exposed to ideological indoctrination and highly traumatic experiences. The international community must prepare now for the return of these foreign fighters and their families. We must be ready with strategies to strengthen the safety of our community and deal with the welfare of these children. This will involve a wide-ranging government response, both between the Commonwealth and the states, and include agencies in the social welfare space that have had little to do with national security issues in the past. Now, while I've spoken at length today about the threat posed by ISIL, other established terrorist groups with long-standing grievances against the West, including Australia, have not disappeared. And over time, history tells us that new terrorist groups will continue to emerge. Groups like Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, and Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, previously known as Jabhat al-Nusra, will continue to pose a threat and are also adopting the effective online recruitment tactics that have so successfully been used by ISIL. There are Australians actively associated with some of these groups offshore, and others sympathetic to the causes they represent here onshore. While the threat we currently face and will continue to face for the foreseeable future overwhelmingly comes from Sunni Islamic extremist groups, there are other ideological motivations at play. And as I mentioned earlier, in August this year, an extreme right-wing activist was charged with Commonwealth offences for the first time. The evolving terrorist threat to Australia is real, and it will continue to change. Your government remains committed to work with our international partners to effectively respond to this threat. Success requires strong laws and modern powers. Importantly, it requires social unity, and I firmly believe security and freedom are not mutually exclusive, but they are mutually reinforcing. A safe community is a strong community, and our unity remains one of our greatest assets in this battle. We have the best law enforcement and security agencies in the world, and they will continue to successfully disrupt attacks here in Australia before they occur. But we must keep the powers that are available to them under constant review and make sure that they have the capabilities that they need to effectively deal with this threat. We also must continue to build a strong and resilient country and strong and resilient communities to deal with this threat for generations to come. Thank you again, Anthony, for the opportunity to present to the Institute. I'm very happy to be here, and of course, I'm very happy to take questions as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister, for an excellent and wide-ranging speech. As the Minister mentioned, he's very kindly agreed to take some questions, and I'll take the Chair's privilege to ask the first one. Over the last 5 years, the international community has been very focused about people going to Iraq and Syria. As you mentioned in your speech, in the next few years, it's going to be more about who's coming out. Does that make you more concerned that, in fact, the terrorist threat that we face in the next few years is going to be worse than the one that we've faced in the last 4 or 5 years?
Look, I think sadly there's the potential for that to be the case. There's no question that we will destroy ISIL in Syria and Iraq, and we're seeing that happening literally every day. And there's now a very wide range of international players involved in that. Some of them, of course, more helpfully than others, but there is an enormous section of the international community who are committed to defeating ISIL, and that will happen. And whilst that happens, it's been described to me, and it's probably quite a good explanation, it's like squeezing a tube of toothpaste. And these guys are going to end up in other parts of the world. They'll go underground in Europe. Very concerningly to us, they'll go underground in our own region. And of course, we don't want to see ISIL establish a presence in the region, and that does remain an ever-present threat to Australia if that were to be the case. Bearing in mind that there is parts of our region, particularly in the southern Philippines, that have been largely ungovernable and subject to a very extensive Islamic insurgency for decades. They could end up in Syria, they could end up in Yemen, they could end up in Libya, of course. They could end up in other parts of the world where there's ungoverned areas. So it's a great concern to us, and of course they could end up here back in Australia. It's a great concern to us. We've been doing a lot of planning for how we're going to address that, and I addressed that in my speech today. So there's no question that the destruction of ISIL, which is a welcome development, does prevent very serious risks, and those risks are going to manifest themselves in lots of different ways over the next few years.
Thanks. I'll now take some questions from the floor. Raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and let us know who you are before you ask your question. Up the back here.
Richard Muse, thank you, Minister, for an excellent speech. I've read in the Washington Post that male children of 5 and 6 are mandatorily recruited by ISIS for not just indoctrination, but also weapons training with AK-47s. You mentioned the new rules on 14-year-olds. How do you actually screen out children who, like Jesuitical historical precedents, have been indoctrinated before the age of 7?
That is a very good question, of course, and there's no easy answer that I can give you to that. Astonishingly, there has been several instances where foreign fighters from Australia have taken their families into the war zone. Islamic State had it's essentially a proto-state. It's clearly not a proper state, but it does have rudimentary educational facilities, and they certainly have been indoctrinating their young people. Now, if you're a 5 or a 6-year-old, that's not your fault, and we need to move forward in Australia, if you were to return, with the welfare of those children uppermost in our mind. And that means we're going to have to engage social services. I think if you've been taken to a war zone by your parents, you've been subject really to horrendous abuse at the hands of your parents. And we need to deal with that as we would do, I think, with other where there's other instances where parents have abused their children. And we need to activate social welfare agencies to help those children, to show them, obviously, that that indoctrination and the messages that they've received is not right, and to bring them back to the community. It'd be nice if we could do that in conjunction with other family members who haven't been infected by this terrible virus of radicalisation. But it will be quite complicated for us to do that. But it will be, I mean, it's those kids have been terrible victims of this, and we need to proceed along the basis that their welfare is the thing that we need to address, and we do need to engage the social services agencies that we have that are run by the states in Australia to ensure that we can do that. But it's going to be quite complicated.
Thanks, Minister. Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute. During the research for that paper we produced, one of the issues that was raised by interlocutors in Turkey was Australia's keenness to prosecute foreign fighters who'd gone to fight for Muslim terrorist organisations, but there didn't seem to be the same keenness to prosecute Australians who'd gone to fight for Kurdish organisations. Could you outline the government's attitude towards Australians fighting with Kurdish organisations and the likelihood of prosecutions of any of them?
Well, look, we don't distinguish. It's illegal in Australia to go and support this war in any way, shape or form, regardless of what side you take. If you're fighting with an organisation that is, well, with one of the pro-Kurdish organisations, you are committing an offence under Australian law, and we do not distinguish. And look, if the Turkish authorities have got that impression, then we need to dispel that impression, because that certainly isn't the case. And I think our actions about prosecuting people when they have returned are a good indication that that is the reality of the situation.
Another question. One of the things that's often been talked about has been what the issue of terrorism raises in terms of the relationship with the Muslim community in Australia. Now, obviously, you know, in and of itself, having a good relationship with the Muslim community is important, whether we're talking about terrorism or not. But you know, a number of heads of security agencies have said how central maintaining that good relationship is in terms of the kind of counter-terrorism fight. It's a tricky exercise. Not everything that's said about the Muslim community is in the gift of the government. We're in a democracy, we're an open society. What progress do you think has been made in terms of managing and strengthening that relationship?
Well, I mean, I think everyone who is familiar with this issue knows that that relationship is just absolutely central to all of our efforts. I mean, it's not the case that we have law enforcement or intelligence communities that are capable of monitoring everybody all of the time, and we rely very heavily on having good relationships with affected communities so they could come to us and say that we're a little bit concerned about something that might be going on, and then we can then take appropriate action. So it is absolutely pivotal that we have the strongest possible relationship with the Muslim community. And we have worked very hard on that in terms of the language that we use, in terms of the programs that we have, and in terms of constantly reinforcing the fact that we make no apology for targeting people that might be doing the wrong thing, but that we never in Australia target communities as a whole. And that's a constant battle, because this is a community that sometimes feels like they're a bit under siege in this environment, and we've got to constantly reinforce the fact that we are not targeting them, and that they are an extraordinarily valuable part of the Australian community, and the Australian government is their government and seeks to be a good government for them. So look, we really are enormously focused on ensuring that that remains the case. There is some challenges, because obviously we live in a country where there is free speech, people are allowed to express different views. I don't discourage them from doing that, but it's important, I think, when those views are expressed, that the government puts the counter view that every Australian is vitally important, and that we seek to work very much with all Australian communities in addressing what is a communal threat.
Yes, over here. Just wait for the microphone.
Minister Glenda Quek from AFP, the International News Agency. You touched briefly on returning foreign fighters and governments having to come up with strategies. Could you perhaps elaborate further what in particular the Australian government is doing to prepare for their return, given what's going on in Iraq now?
Well, we've always known that at some stage we are going to have an influx of Australians who have fought in this conflict returning to Australia. And we've spent an enormous amount of time thinking about how we're going to address that. One of the best things we can do, of course, is exclude people from the country. And we do have legislation in Australia that allows us to cancel the citizenship of dual nationals. For those who we, and that's going to be a smaller cohort of people. And for those who are sole nationals, we are required to take you back under international law. And we've got to make sure that we have a regime that allows us to ensure that if you have fought in the conflict, and for those reasons that I outlined in the speech, that you might have a network, you might have skills, and you might continue to be a threat to the community, that we've got police and we've got others in this area with the powers that they need to ensure that you're not going to be harmful to the community. So we've got new offences, particularly declared areas. So if we can show that you're in a declared area, and the Foreign Minister has declared Raqqa and Mosul as declared areas, if we can prove that you were there, then you have prima facie committed an offence, and we will prosecute you for that. We've enhanced our ability, if we can't get a successful prosecution, to put control orders on people, for example, where we can control their movements, make sure that you're not doing things that would represent a risk to the community. And we've changed the way that we can use evidentiary material collected overseas in Australian courts, because that traditionally has been very, very difficult to do. So if you return here, we want to prosecute you and put you in prison for your crimes. If that is not possible to do, and of course there will be degrees of offending and there will be differing levels of our ability to run a successful prosecution, then we've got other mechanisms at the disposal of our agencies to neutralise any threat that you might face to the community. But we have spent a lot of time dealing with thinking about what we're going to do, and there's a special unit within the government that will address people on a case-by-case basis.
One of the interesting questions that question raises is, obviously one concern is about Australians coming home, but there's also must be a concern about Australians leaving Iraq and Syria and going elsewhere and committing these offences. What are the steps we're taking to ensure that that also doesn't happen, or that we work as part of international efforts to ensure that Australians are not involved in committing acts of terrorism outside of Australia?
Well, that's a good question, and I know that the research that's been prepared by the Institute did focus a little on that, and that was sort of useful. Look, we're obviously not, we've done everything we can to discourage Australians from joining the war zone, particularly for one of those reasons. We don't want Australians contributing to this conflict. And there was some discussion at the time about whether we'd just be better off letting people go, of course, or whether we're better off stopping them. And we've cancelled 190 passports. And we've done other things to disrupt people's travel plans. A very significant number of Australians who have gone to the war zone have died, and a very significant number of them will continue to die because they're used as cannon fodder by ISIL. I mean, often they're put on the front lines even without a weapon. So there will continue to be an enormous number of casualties. For those that do survive, if they return home, we'll seek to prosecute them. If they go elsewhere, obviously we have lesser control over them, but we will continue to work very extensively with our friends, our allies, some of them not even traditional allies or not countries where traditionally Australia has had a very strong law enforcement or intelligence relationship, but we will work with the global community. We've enhanced our presence in the Middle East, as I said, in Jordan, in Turkey. And we will continue to work with the global anti-ISIL coalition to address Australians that would continue to present a risk to the international community in every way that we can.
Thank you, Minister. Ewan Graham with the Institute. You mentioned military efforts in passing, but I just wonder if you can look further forward down the track when eventually the ADF commitment ends over Iraq and Syria. What mandate would continue to exist for our defence forces in counterterrorism? What forms might that take, and where would it apply?
I think the first part of your question is probably above my pay grade at this stage. How we're going to proceed on that will obviously depend on how quickly we destroy
the so-called Islamic State, to how quickly we just, you know, we sort of take them out of the areas that they have managed to physically control, and then what happens afterwards. I suppose the second part of the question is quite a different question about the way we use the ADF for counter-terrorism operations in Australia. And I know that there's been some commentary about this in relation to the Lindt Cafe siege. We do have very specialised capability based in Sydney and Perth with commandos and the SAS, Tag East and Tag West. They have a quite remarkable range of capability, and they have capability that is not available to the government in any other agency. So there's things that they can do that nobody else in Australia can do, and we would certainly deploy them if we had an incident where we were required to use that specialist capability. And they're, you know, what they can do is just quite remarkable. But in terms of the way we respond to an incident such as a siege or such as a terrorism incident in any of our major cities, the police will continue to be the first responders for a whole variety of reasons. And we do train them extensively to deal with this. For example, the AFP's Specialist Response Group trains directly with their ADF counterparts, and they do have an enormous skill set available to them to deal with this. And it does remain the case that the police are best able to respond to this, notwithstanding I know there has been some commentary saying that we should use the ADF more. We will certainly deploy the ADF in circumstances where their high-tech and extensive capability is required. But in terms of the way we respond to terrorist incidents, as a general rule, it will be the police that are the first responders.
Thank you. Anthony Zwi, University of New South Wales. You've spoken a lot about reducing the causes of violent extremism through tackling social and employment and other forms of disaffection locally. I was wondering if you could say something about what role development outside of Australia plays and how the Australian government sees the importance of development cooperation, reducing inequality, stimulating civil society, supporting the UN, those types of activities as part of the response to global instability and terror?
Well, I suppose we deal, we deal with it in different ways. Look, I mean, there is global mechanisms for us to be able to deal with this, and Australia, of course, as a responsible citizen, always plays its part. I think probably more importantly and more effectively is the bilateral relationships that we have within our region. They are very important. We do work with friendly governments in the region on countering violent extremism, in particular with Indonesia, and we've got a very good relationship with some non-government actors there, for example, where we work with them as the Australian government to assist with their programs. And that sort of countering violent extremism effort is absolutely a global effort. I mean, ISIL propaganda is online, it's global, it's accessible to everyone in the region in exactly the same way via the internet and via those sorts of platforms that I talked about in my speech. And our response needs to be the same. I mean, there's no reason why arguments against ISIL, putting the truth about what's actually going on out there, can't effectively be used in Indonesia, as in Australia, as in Malaysia. And where we've got good programs dealing with countering violent extremism, we need to share our experience with each other. And Australia has used its good offices in the region to bring everyone together to do that. We've had a summit here in Sydney. There's been follow-up summits in various parts around the world also. And the civilized world, if you like, all these people that ISIL has been targeting do need to share their experiences on this, but we are doing that quite effectively.
Alex Carradas, interested member of the public. With returning terrorists going to, say, Europe, say a country like Bulgaria, are we satisfied that we have sufficient information sharing to identify these people should they then want to transit to Australia?
There is good global cooperation and intelligence sharing on returning foreign fighters. And in fact, because of the scale of the challenge and the nature of the challenge, it has pushed the international community to be better at sharing information. The nature of intelligence information is that people in the intelligence community don't readily share. I mean, we have a very good relationship with the Five Eyes, but it's not the case that, you know, because it's always about controlling information, that it's a natural predisposition, I suppose, for the intelligence community to share. But we have been pushed into it over the last 2.5 years in particular, and I think those relationships, particularly with some of our non-traditional partners, are as strong as they ever have been. Certainly from the Australian government's perspective, if we had information that was of concern to any of our friends in the international community, we would obviously share it with them. We wouldn't carry information where there was a risk to somebody in the international community and not act on it. And we would certainly hope that that same approach would be used by others in the international community, where so they had information that was relevant to Australia, they would share it with us. We know that we've got traditional intelligence relationships where that sharing is seamless, but we need to make sure that on a wider international basis that information is shared that helps us to build this intelligence picture to sort of all keep our own nationals safe.
Thank you, Minister. Geoffrey White, I just wanted to ask you what the chances are of people slipping through the cracks in this refugee program in a terrorist side.
For the refugee program that we run in Australia, the risks are minuscule and tiny, because we are vetting people in an incredibly comprehensive way, and also because of the cohort that we are accepting from the conflict zone, which is persecuted minorities. Now, by the nature of being in a persecuted minority, your chances of being radicalised by this sort of radical Sunni ideology is incredibly low. So I think that us taking refugees from the war zone is of very limited security concern to us, because of the processes we're going through before anyone sets foot in Australia. Now, for others in the international community, clearly those refugee flows in an uncontrolled way, and I'm talking about Europe, are unbelievably risky and have resulted in ISIL using those refugee flows to send people into Europe who have subsequently committed acts of terror. So they represent an enormous risk for our friends and allies, which of course concerns us, because we don't like to see our friends and allies under this sort of attack. And, you know, it is a very big challenge for Europe to deal with this, and we will assist them in any way that we can. But the people that we're taking in Australia do not represent that same sort of risk, and I'm very satisfied about that.
I have one final question just here.
Hi, Laura Tantum. I wanted to ask you about the threat of terrorists using cyber means. So a recent report said that their capabilities are pretty low at the moment. But is the government using the same protective measures against to protect the country against someone picking up a gun or using a bomb as they are if they use cyber means to conduct an attack?
Look, that is a very good question. Look, the government is taking a whole range of measures to protect us in the area of cyber. In fact, we've got a minister who's now been appointed to take responsibility for Australia's cybersecurity strategy. The threat posed by terrorist organisations of ISIL is probably a smaller part of our concerns, still a part of our concerns, but a smaller part of our concerns. I mean, obviously in this area, you know, there's state actors, there's non-state actors, there's incredibly sophisticated players, there's very sophisticated criminal groups, and there's increasing sophistication amongst terrorist groups as well. And we do need a comprehensive whole-of-government strategy that means that we're securing the Commonwealth's infrastructure from threat, but also that we're working with others in the Australian community who might be under threat. So businesses, of course, are at risk of cyber penetration in a way that can certainly damage our national interests. So we've had a very good look at this. The Prime Minister launched our strategy earlier on in the year. He's very committed to it. Obviously, you know, he's very interested in cyber and all things digital. And we have got a comprehensive approach to this, which involves significant extra investment, but also working with others in the community that might be at risk of cyber penetration. So, yes, we are concerned about the increasing capability of terrorist groups, and we are taking action, but that's part of our broader action on cyber threats.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to bring our event today to a close. Minister, it's been a great pleasure to host you again. You know, to some degree, it's unfortunate that we're hosting you again, that we're still, you know, a bit of a year since you spoke to us last, talking about this issue and in many respects. We're probably going to be talking about it for some time yet. Nevertheless, it's great to have you talk in such broad ways about the different things that the government's doing in addressing this challenge. So please join me in thanking Michael Keane.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you. See you next time.